Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios, New York City. You can listen to this program anytime you'd like. I'll give you a number that you can call in, listen live, if you're traveling any place, as many people do. And that way you don't miss it. Broadcasting every single day, noon to 1 Eastern Standard Time, and then other stations pick it up and play it when they choose. Here's that number, 712-775-6850. 712-775-6850. Today, why don't we feel more guilty about eating animals? From Queen Mary University in London. And then magnesium deficiency triggers many chronic disease symptoms. And then from University of California, San Francisco, working up a sweat may protect men from lethal prostate cancer. And the University of Toronto, couples who have sex weekly are happiest. What about daily? What about hourly? Well, they're in nirvana. Then we're going to talk about how the American opiate epidemic was started by one pharmaceutical company, from Mike Mariani from Pacific Standard. We're going to look at something that Dr. Gary Coles wrote about the unwelcome facts about America's over-vaccinated schedule. Wow, I'm looking at the new schedule. Way too many vaccines people are receiving. And from the environmental segment, West Antarctic ice cascades towards crisis. Tim Radford from London. We'll talk about that as well. Time permitting, toxins remain in your clothes. How many? Which ones? How they get there? Why is it important? We'll discuss all that. Let's begin. I have been a vegetarian and vegan for a long time. And one of the reasons was when I was very young, out in the country at a farm that my family shared during the summertime, my father was a partner in it, they had animals. And like most Americans, they raised animals, they slaughtered them, ate them. I befriended them. When you have little animals that are friendly and very smart and very loving, you realize that they're not just a steak or a piece of pork chop. They're a sentient being. They have a connection to you. And if you get children playing with animals, especially farm animals, far less likely they're going to want to eat them. And today, one of the things I do when I do retreats is I always make sure that people have a chance, if they choose, to just relate with a little creature. And that might be a guinea hen, it might be a miniature horse or miniature pig, it might be a monkey, whatever it is, so they can look in their eyes and see love and see a smart mind. And then it suddenly changes how they would view that if it was on a menu. I've seen a lot of people come away from a retreat and not want to eat an animal again. In fact, when I first had my first big ranch down in Texas, it was the old Gene Autry place. It was run down when I bought it and took a long time to fix it up. But when it was finally open in 1989, we had an enormous amount of people from New York want to come. And I could only be available 1 month a year. And my brother lived there. I actually bought it for him. And he always wanted to be a cowboy. We were hillbilly, so going from being a hillbilly and to a cowboy was a big deal. And I can tell you, you could never imagine someone being happier than my brother on his horse and his cowboy hat riding around the property. And then sitting with the good old boys down there and sharing stories from their culture and our culture. So I'd go down in August. Now, it doesn't seem very smart to be in Texas, West Texas, in August because it's hot. But we had a beautiful big lake, 12-acre lake, and the way the house was built and designed, it had always breezes going. People would have a great time, but I had a lot of animals. I mean, hundreds. Most of them were rescue animals. People who couldn't afford their animals, just let them to die. We would find out. A vet would call us and say, can you take some more? And I'd say, sure. And so at one time we had about 500 different animals. And you first have to get the animal to trust you again. If you go towards it and you see it's pulling its head back, more often than not, it's been smacked or whipped or beaten. And it takes time. But in time, when the animal realizes you're not going to hurt it, in fact, you just do just the opposite. You pet it, you scratch its neck and its head, give it hugs, give it food. It actually looks forward to come on over to you, and it gains a whole new sense of trust. I remember there was a lawyer from New York who came, and he was really stressed, and he had a lot going on. He didn't tell me what was going on. He just said, I'm really at a stressed place in my life. A lot of stuff is not happening the way I'd hoped. I'm having a lot of crisis, and I needed just to come down here. He says, otherwise I'd never be in a ranch with people. And so he said, what do you recommend? And I said, come with me. So I took him out to a pasture, and in this pasture was Mary. Mary was a huge cow, really big, and she had many of her calves, her daughters, were there also. And Mary was laying there chewing her cud, and I just sat on the ground, leaned back, and I said, sit down, lean back. And he didn't want to. He was afraid. Look at that big cow. I'm not going to have it. I said, the cow's not going to do anything to you. It's a gentle cow. It's a nursing cow. It's a loving cow. So he sat down. And, you know, he's a little hesitant. He was a little tight. But after we just sat there and just appreciated the breeze coming through and watching butterflies and doing nothing, saying nothing. And then I said, any time you want, you can come out to this pasture, day or night. And she is better than any psychologist, psychotherapist. Just enjoy being with this wonderful creature. Well, it took 2 days, and I didn't see him anymore. Yoga, meditation, even my lectures in the evening, he was out there. And at the end of the week, he said, I've solved a lot of my problems in my own mind. I've de-stressed, something I wasn't able to do before in New York. And I'll never eat any meat again. Good. It worked. Not just for him, but for a lot of people. Had a little heifer. Had a little zebu cow, which is a very small cow. It's only about 32 inches, which means it doesn't even come up to your waist. Fully grown. And people loved being around it. It loved people. It'd give you kisses. And you talk about a natural tranquilizer. Let a little heifer come up and start giving you kisses and look in those big round eyes. You just melt. Just warms your heart. But that was the reality. So there are many ways to solve problems. I believe in doing it spiritually, naturally, and honestly. So when we stop eating meat, we're honoring our true spiritual self. But that's not easy for a lot of people. This is from Queen Mary University in London. Quote, ham is made from the pig, isn't it? That's what was the question confronted by this writer, this woman who wrote this, during a recent trip to a local zoo with my young daughter. She had taken a break from feeding Alice, the zoo's resident pig, to inhale her own lunch, a ham sandwich, irony, when suddenly she made the connection, I like Alice, she's my friend. This moment of realization didn't seem to present a problem for the precocious four-year-old, but for many adults, the connection between the meat on their plate and a living, feeling animal is more problematic. This is evident in the increasing number of vegetarians, which ranges from as little as 2% of the population in some developed countries to 30% in India. By the way, it's 2% in the United States. The rest of us, those who would rather eat cardboard than tofu, arm ourselves with a variety of psychological techniques to overcome the moral dilemma of being responsible for the suffering and death of another living creature. This dilemma is often called the meat paradox. The term refers to the mental conflict between our moral belief that it's wrong to inflict suffering or death on sentient beings and our desire to enjoy a guilt-free sausage sandwich. This kind of psychological brain squabble is referred to as cognitive dissonance. It's a mental tug of war. Cognitive dissonance occurs whenever someone holds two contradictory beliefs. It can manifest as a range of emotions, including anger, embarrassment, and guilt. We can see it in people's desire to smoke despite the significant dangers to their health, or in the continuing use of petroleum-based cars despite accepting the threat of climate change. To see this climate firsthand, this conflict firsthand, try reminding the next person you see eating a bacon sandwich of its cute piggy origin. Most people are hardwired to curb the self-flagellation that occurs whenever we focus our thinking on the subject causing our cognitive dissonance. The logical way for us to silence any meat-focused mental backchat would simply be to alter our eating habits and avoid the problem in the first place. While this might seem like a straightforward change, arguing that it is a simple move vastly underestimates how deeply ingrained eating meat is in most cultures. Eating meat forms a key part of many traditions and ceremonies as well as everyday cooking, but can also convey status. For example, male vegetarians are often perceived as less masculine compared with their meat-eating counterparts. Plus, many of us really, really like the taste of it. This means we need a different approach to end the cerebral tug-of-war playing out in our heads. This typically begins by undermining the inconvenient belief that consuming animals entails harming them. A common mechanism for doing this is by denying that farm animals think in the same way humans do, or even other more intelligent animals, usually pets. This reduces their inherent worth in our minds and places them outside the circle of moral concern. Surely our treatment of a cow or pig is irrelevant if they're too stupid to think and feel. But they do think and feel. Some might argue that our designation of certain animals as food is due to our understanding and knowledge of the species inhabiting our world. For example, the UK greeted the recent mislabeling of horse meat with outrage. Why? Because it was from horses. Yet many countries, including France and some of the UK's closest neighbors, have no problem eating horses. In China, in South Vietnam, in Cambodia, in the Philippines, they eat dogs and cats and kittens and puppies. You can go to a market and see a whole bunch of caged animals alive. They just throw them into boiling water and boil them alive. They're not upset about it. Again, while many of us would be horrified at the thought of eating our dog or cat, this is by no means a universal reaction and is heavily dependent upon our cultural and familial influences. So this representation of livestock as dumb allows us to ignore growing evidence that farm animals lead complex mental and emotional lives and avoid modifying our behavior. We then reinforce the status quo by avoiding anything that may trigger further dissonance, including those pesky vegetarians. Just reading a description of this group of people causes us to increase our disparagement of animals' mental abilities. Similarly, supermarkets sell us meat that bears no resemblance to its animal origin. Some people are even disgusted by fish with a head on, never mind larger animals. We buy beef and pork instead of cow and pig to aid the process of disassociation. We rarely seek out information on farm animals' welfare, preferring to devolve responsibility to higher powers. And when faced with evidence of animal suffering, we just simply say, eat it and forget about it. Those of us more aware of animal production methods might buy welfare-friendly products to affirm our delusions of cows skipping through green fields. This perceived behavioral change reduces our guilt, allowing us to take the moral high ground and still eat burgers. Avoiding psychological strife in this way might allow us to continue eating meat, but it also reveals a disturbing link between devaluing of animals and the dehumanization of our own kind. Reducing the intelligence and moral worth of people we consider outsiders is often linked to discrimination and is understood to be an important mechanism in the lead-up to many atrocities in human history. But just as our awareness of and attitudes towards human discrimination have changed, so may our views on the mass farming of animals for food. The lengths we go to avoid confronting our cognitive dissonance overeating meat suggest it might be wise to reevaluate how comfortable we are with our current level of consumption, the mental hoops we jump through just to accept this. Now, a couple thoughts on this. First, a few years ago, there was a race of all the teams, competing teams in the Metropolitan Athletic Congress. That's the overall governing body for the whole industry of racing in New York. So the New York Athletic Club, which has the most members, I think about that 40,000 at that time in the New York Athletic Club, the Eastside Track Club, and our Natural Living and Running Walking Club, which is over 35 years old. And to my knowledge, we were the only vegans. And you have three people do a 10K, 6.2-mile relay. And there was Sam Skinner and Sid Howard and myself. Just saw Sid the other day. And Sid and Sam, we're going to do some filming and running this weekend, so give me a call at 646-926-5422. Glad this came to mind. So anyhow, here we are, and we get out there, and we get in this race with these, I think there was 112 teams. So you're competing against over 330 people. We won. We won a gold medal. We won it twice, in fact. And it was interesting because almost all the other athletes know you when you're winning a lot of races, and Sam and I were Outstanding Athlete of the Year with the Metropolitan Congress on three occasions. The indoor series, I won that. And then two outdoor series of competing athletes, some 40,000, twice nominated 14 to 15 times, as was Sam and Sid Howard. I don't know about Sam. Sam won a lot of races. So here we are, vegan, winning races, but not just a couple races. I've won over 660. My latest was just a month ago, and I'm going to do 8 races this year. Sam hasn't lost a race. He's won in his age group almost every single race. Sid Howard is considered one of the two greatest milers and half milers in the world and has been for 20 years. Now, set that aside a second. Let me show you Mr. Universe, Mr. World, Mr. America. Let me show you some of the strongest men and women on the planet. Let me show you some of the greatest athletes on the planet. Vegan, Carl Lewis, and others. Yet that part of their ability to be long-term competitors. Mind you, I'm still a competitive athlete. Sam is a competitive athlete. Sid Howard's a competitive athlete. We're still competing. When a lot of the meat eaters, long ago, the arachidonic acid, the saturated fats, the pro-inflammatory cytokines have wrecked their knees, their muscles, and their joints, and their body. Not ours. So I believe at some point, the biases against veganism or vegetarianism should be lifted long enough to show how many athletes out there are not only competing, but winning in their respective fields, and yet almost zero acknowledgement of this. I think if that was shown as a model for teenagers and young kids, then we just wouldn't be looking at the LeBron James or the other great athletes, no question about it, and I respect them in their athleticism. But wouldn't it be nice to raise kids to also value the welfare and life of an animal? So if you had 1 million athletic kids growing up who chose to go vegetarian and knew how to be strong and competitive, Think of how nice that would be for them, their families, their future health, the lack of disease, living a longer life, not as susceptible to heart attacks, diabetes and stroke, and obesity and mental illness, and saving the planet also because you're lowering the carbon footprint. So you see the consequences of these choices are many. Finally, magnesium deficiency triggers chronic disease symptoms. This is a major issue. Quote, while magnesium is the second most abundant mineral in the cells of the human body, it also represents the second most common deficiency. Magnesium is involved in over 300 biochemical processes throughout the body, but one of its most important tasks is producing energy. In that capacity, it becomes indispensable to all cellular processes, and understanding the danger signs of a magnesium deficiency can rid you of bothersome, mysterious symptoms while lowering your risk of serious health. So let's just make sure that you want a healthy heart, you want a healthy heart rhythm, you want to overcome things that are associated with magnesium deficiency. Well, how about magnesium can effectively reduce your risk of cardiovascular disease, diabetes, autism, fibromyalgia, chronic pain, osteoporosis, and headaches. Read magnesium research, where scientists showed that it even helps kids diagnosed with ADHD. Marked improvement. So, did you know that the heart has the highest amount of magnesium of anywhere in your body? And without that magnesium, your heart simply would not function properly? So let's do the right thing. Get between 800 to 1,200 milligrams of magnesium a day. And one final thing, onions cut heart disease risk. From the Institute of Food Research, quote, eating a meal rich in flavonoids that are common in onions reduced some early signs of heart disease. And that was presented by the BBC. They're suggesting 1 to 200 milligrams of onion. That's a small amount, in my opinion. How many times have you heard me say, an onion a day keeps a stroke away, lowers your blood pressure, and it's true. So, more confirmation of that. Get your sweet onion in there, and that'll make a difference. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Nice to have you with us, everyone. We have a lot of stuff to share with you. Please stay with us. In studio, we have Vern, and Vern has a background in nutrition research and counseling people, helping people. And one of the things you're doing, Vern, is you're helping people who want to make a transition from a meat-based diet, eating the pork chops and the big, you know, barbecued spare ribs and the deep-fried chickens, to a healthy state so they can help overcome diabetes, heart disease, lose weight, help them with their emotions. Do you find it's easy or difficult for people to make that journey?
Thank you, Gary. I find that it's easier if people understand what are the factors that make them want food that is not health supportive. If they understand why they crave that information, why they crave that food, it becomes much easier to make that transition. Aside from the education, aside from pain, aside from a need, people need to understand what are the factors that makes it more desirable to eat those foods. So when you understand the mechanism of cravings, it becomes much easier to make such transitions.
Good. Vern is here to help those in this audience who want to make a transition in their life, people who want to go from being eating dairy and wheat and sugar, might have sugar addictions, dairy addictions, tobacco addictions, drug addictions, and live a healthier life. I've hired him because of his deep, rich background, best-selling author on health books. He's an example of a healthy vegan, and he will guide you. He will help you, even show you how to shop, so that those who want to make the change, you now have someone, and it costs you zero. Vern's paid a very nice wage, so he can help you for free. That's the deal. Call 212-874-4000, 212-874-4000, ask for Vern, V-E-R-N-E, and he will guide you and help you become a healthy, dynamic vegan. Thank you, Vern.
Thank you. Look forward.
Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Nice to have you with us. In this segment of our program, I'm going to go through a lot of topics very quickly to just show you what's happening around the world and some things that make sense and some things that do not make sense. But one of the things that concerns me is the power of the media to control our thoughts on issues that are important. Now, we know that we have a crisis. We have some people acknowledging that we are the main reason this crisis exists in the world. I saw Ron Paul last evening on television, and he was very clear when the person said, would you believe that we hold any responsibility for ISIS and the immigration problems right now? And he said, absolutely, we're the cause, and he is correct. And we have delineated that in detail in previous programs, so I won't go there. I do feel that you should listen carefully to this gentleman talk about one case that I didn't know about, I don't know if you knew about, Anne Frank. We all know about Anne Frank, but here's what you probably don't know about Anne Frank.
Republican, mostly Republican, U.S. governors have said, we are not going to take in Syrian refugees, period. Chris Christie went as far as saying that Syrian orphans under age 5 don't belong here. Jeb Bush and Ted Cruz have both suggested we just admit Christian refugees. This is obviously a combination of dumb and dangerous and against the law. We have the Immigration Act that is in place and prevents states from violating federal immigration policy. These Republican governors don't care. Doesn't matter. A couple interesting articles have been written over the last 2 days, reminding us that Anne Frank was a refugee who was denied entrance to the United States. According to documents discovered a few years ago, Anne Frank's father, and of course Anne Frank and the Frank family, Otto Frank, etc., hid in an attic that I visited in Amsterdam last year. During World War II, they were Jewish. They were ultimately found. They were ultimately killed. It was all to try to avoid being sent to concentration camps during the Holocaust. It's been uncovered that Anne Frank's father wrote numerous letters to U.S. officials pleading for permission to immigrate with his family. Most of these were written between April and December of 1941, in the months following the Nazi occupation of the Netherlands, where they had been exiled. And at the end of 1941, after the family was pleading and getting ignored, the Franks ultimately went into hiding until they were discovered and sent to Auschwitz. And in 1945, Anne and her sister Margot died of typhoes in the Bergen-Belsen concentration camps. People are generally familiar with the story of Anne Frank, but there is not as much discussion of why they were not allowed refugee status here in the United States. And the reason was that after World War I, Congress passed the Immigration Restriction Act of 1924, which set up a quota system that discouraged the immigration of Jews, Italians, and other undesirables. People ask me, Lewis, David, your family, Eastern European Jews, left Europe to Argentina. Why Argentina instead of coming to the U.S.? There were immigration quotas for Jews. Those had been used up, so my family ended up in Argentina. Why do so many Italians? Why is Argentinian culture so Italian? Same reason. There were quotas for Italian immigrants to the United States. Italians ended up in Argentina. What can we learn from all this? It's not about Anne Frank specifically, necessarily, but it is to remind us that when we start talking about religion-based immigration and refugee status, when we start talking about keeping people out merely based on country of origin or merely based on self-professed beliefs, we are opening ourselves up to the same type of policy that led to Anne Frank. Anne Frank, certainly no risk to anybody, staying in the Netherlands, ultimately being sent to a concentration camp and dying. That is the direct connection.
Yeah, and is there any doubt in your mind that we have a Congress full of people who would love to pass similar legislation right now? I mean, I think
of
that...
There's no doubt at all.
I mean, it probably won't happen, but any bill that lands on the president's desk, of course, like that will be vetoed. But who will the next president be, Dave? I mean, anything can happen here.
Anything can happen. What's absolutely. And
no, that's just one point of view. Rarely do I agree with anything from Harry Reid, but he made some sense here. I'll play you a short piece of this.
Israel Goldfarb. He and his family came from Russia. They were refugees escaping the pogroms of the Tsar. I've been disgusted, Mr. President, in recent days to see some of my Republican colleagues shun the American tradition of displaying compassion for those in need, of sheltering those fleeing death, torture, rape, and oppression. Frankly, I've been disappointed by Republican fear-mongering and bigotry. Apparently, they've learned nothing from history. We cannot repeat the dark days of the 1930s, when many Americans resolved to turn away the helpless refugees fleeing Nazi Germany, Adolf Hitler, or imprisoning of innocent Japanese Americans during World War II. Like our late colleague, Dan Inouye, and his family. Those mistakes were based on misguided fears of people we didn't know. And how many people died because of unfounded apprehension? I don't know, but far too many. Yet it seems many Republicans are destined to go down that same path again. Some in the Republican Party have suggested that we categorically block all Syrian refugees. One Republican candidate for president suggests we turn away even five-year-old refugee children. Two other Republican candidates for president implied that the United States of America should have some sort of religious test for refugees. They're saying only Christians. This is the latest in what has become a disturbing pattern of Republican hatred and intolerance toward Muslims. Remember, Syria is mostly Muslim. But they're Jews, they're Christians, lots of them. During the course of the current presidential cycle, we've heard from the leading lights of the Republican Party the following: that we're at war with Islam, that we should be shutting down Muslim houses of worship in America, close the mosques, that we should ban Muslims from government service. We have two of my friends who serve in the House of Representatives who are Muslim. They're proud. That religion has made them better people. And now that they're even suggesting we should reject refugees fleeing persecution on the grounds they're Muslim. That's not America. That is hate emanating from some Republicans.
That is correct. And also remember, the vast majority of terrorist acts in the United States since 9/11 were not by Muslims. They were by rabid right-wing or extremist groups in the United States, white supremacists, and that is simply a matter of fact. In any case, I just wanted to offer some input since I've heard the mainstream media, and they have not been balanced in this. Now, I want to go to some other issues that are not getting any attention, but I feel are important. This is from Christine June, and it's America's Dumbest Governor appoints creationist as education commissioner. And this is just remarkable to me. Quote, Republican Governor of Maine, Paul LePage, making a face after taking the stage to debate other gubernatorial candidates in Portland, Maine. And then it goes on to say that Maine's new education commissioner, thinks creationism belongs in school. LePage just appointed Bill Beardsley as Maine's acting education commissioner, and LePage and Beardsley agree that Maine's young should be taught creationism alongside evolution in public schools. Now just understand the concept. How do you wrap your mind around knowing how many stages of evolution we've had with humans alone, plus dinosaurs, and they're going to teach kids that dinosaurs and humans were on Noah's Ark together, that there was a Noah's Ark, that the world was created in 7 days, that this is just mind-numbing. But that's happening. This is a letter about an article from one of Israel's premier peace advocates, Yuri Avnery. This letter is from Rabbi Michael Lerner. It's short, but I thought it was relevant. Quote, "The sad reality of racism in Israel has been known to many of us for decades, a tragedy for the people which has suffered so much from the racism directed against us. Its first manifestation was in the early Zionist claim that its attempt to build a Jewish society in Palestine was merely directing Jew refugees to a land without people for a people without land, making invisible the hundreds of thousands of Arabs who lived there by the early part of the 20th century. Next manifestation was in the scorn and discrimination with which the Sephardic Mizrahi Jews escaping from Arab countries were treated by the Ashkenazi Jews who shaped the pre-1948 Jewish settlements in Palestine. It has reached monumental proportions against Palestinians in contemporary Israel, yet most Israelis pretend that their discriminatory treatment of Palestinians is only a reaction to the insecurity that Jewish Israelis feel in relationship to the Palestinians, denying the other element that is a major part of the psychodynamics of the conflict, namely the guilt that Israelis feel at being oppressors, which is then denied, repressed, split off, and manifest in racist portrayals of those they are dominating and hurting. Yet finally, in the last few years, that racism became harder to deny as it manifested towards African refugees seeking asylum in Israel and the many other non-Jews who Israel imported to fill the menial jobs that would no longer be filled by Palestinians once Israel decided to cut off the Gaza West Bank located Palestinians from working in Israel. Now, this latest incident, which Avery discusses, demonstrates the racism ever more clearly and tragically. For those of us who care deeply about the Jewish people and worry about the tendency in much of the Jewish world to blindly worship the State of Israel, the latest manifestation of this idolatry that has often undermined true Jewish commitment to God. This racism is particularly distressing. Yet it is a bit problematic for us in the United States to get too self-righteous about Israel's racism without also acknowledging that racism is deep within almost every form of nationalism on the planet. Certainly there is that in Russia, China, the Arab states, European states, turning away Syrian refugees, and the list goes on. Most obvious is the racism that continues to shape American society from its beginnings in the genocide of Native Americans and the enslavement of Africans, but carrying right through to this moment when so much of the appeal the Republican Party is based upon, sometimes covert signals, but just as often overt policies, racism against African Americans, Latinos, and the list grows. So much of what resonates in the Republicans' call for reduced size of government is the covert message that those people, meaning the non-white minorities, are getting too much from the government and our money is being given to them. The huge shift in American politics in the 1970s and 80s came when the Democrats were perceived as having become champions of the anti-racist agenda. A huge exaggeration, to be sure, since Democrats barely touched the economic foundations of contemporary racism. And so the former racists of the South and Midwest, who had aligned with the Democratic Party, jumped to a Republican Party no longer connected with the legacy of its first president, Abraham Lincoln, and by the 1970s and 80s, clearly willing to assault all those who cared for the most oppressed minorities. Their base, ironically, was often white middle-income and working-class people whose economic interests were better served by the Democrats, but who could not withstand the allure of racist hatred offered through the code language of the Republicans. Not the whole story, to be sure. But so we in the West must approach the racism in Israel's society with a bit of humility about our own failure to deal with racism in our own societies. But for those of us who love Israel, it is nevertheless appropriate to express sadness at the way our own people have shut their hearts to the stranger, the other, even at the expense of ignoring one of the Torah's most frequently repeated commands, to love and not oppress the stranger, the other. In Hebrew, the Haggra, reminding us some 2,500 years ago that we must do this. It is with this sadness that we read about Uri Avnery talking about, and he is the leading Israeli philosopher and peace activist, about racism in Israel. In quote, Rabbi Michael Lerner. Also, I want to share some additional insights, for example, on poverty. We have not really understood what's at work here. Let me first share with you The Guardian and James Kasparovic article on poverty pay leads Walmart employees to skip lunch or steal from his coworkers. Then I'll give a comment on this. Here's what's important. Walmart employees are so poor that they're skipping lunch, sharing it, or in some cases, stealing it from their coworkers. Some of the company workers claimed this just yesterday while announcing a fast to protest the company's wages. Now, starting today, over 100 Walmart associates who are members of Our Walmart, a workers' organization, about 1,000 supporters, will begin to fast to shine light on what they describe as Walmart's poverty pay. The protest comes in the run-up to Thanksgiving and Black Friday shopping bonanzas, one of Walmart's busiest periods. And earlier this year, Walmart announced it was raising wages for about a half a million of its employees to $9 an hour. Well, the workers say that that's still not enough and demand that they be paid $15 an hour and be given full-time schedules. One person who lives in Sacramento, a woman named Faulkner, said this, and I thought this was interesting, quote, every day there are associates who go to work with no lunch or an unhealthy lunch because that's all they can afford. I've seen instances where some would eat another's associate's lunch from the refrigerator because they had nothing to eat. One of the things I remember most from working at Walmart was my friends and I emptying our pockets to scrape together one meal we could all share for lunch. One of my coworkers put in a dollar, another $2, and with my $2 we could buy a chicken from Walmart's deli and split it between us. That was lunch. I don't know if they had dinner. Denise Barledge, who worked at Walmart for 9 years before being laid off during the store's closing in Pico Rivera, California, said that break room conversations at the store often focused on workers having to choose between paying for gas to get home or buying lunch. Quote, these are decisions no one should have to make. There were times my own lunch was stolen, leaving me to think someone needed it more than me. So my suggestion is this. Look at it by pulling back for a moment. When you shop at Walmart, and yes, there are deals there, you're actually enabling the Walton family that collectively, the sisters and the son, have over $150 billion. They don't need to be exploiting the people. If they raised all their employees to $15, that would at least allow some people not to have those concerns about not being able to afford a lunch. Also, they could give a free lunch to every employee. I do, and have for decades, and dinner as well. Anyone working that shift gets a free dinner. They work in the afternoon. They work later. They get both. They could also bring down the profit of the corporation just by a relatively small amount. When you're the largest retailer in the world and you're making hundreds of billions of dollars, to mark off $1 billion as additional pay for employees is a small amount to pay. To also show some sense of empathy and understanding what it is to be the other. To have the wealth they have, which they could never spend, and to be senior citizens and approaching the end of their lives, and not to realize what they could do for their 1.5 million workers, is the issue. I believe that we should all boycott Walmart. Now you can say, well, that's not good because they'll just lay off workers. And I'm suggesting that as long as we continue to support them, meaning Walmart, the money is not benefiting the workers. It is benefiting the owners. Protest and boycott. Show the owners of Walmart and their board of directors, of which Hillary Clinton was one, that we care for the workers. Show solidarity. And on this Black Friday and Thanksgiving and Christmas holiday, don't buy a single thing for anyone, not a single gift. If you want to give the gift of joy, happiness, love, affection, and passion, and creativity. Write a beautiful letter about the meaning of someone in your life. If you want to take someone to a movie or a play or a walk in the park, share that quality time with them. If it's with kids, share that energy with them. Take your kids out to a homeless center and then have them spend the whole day giving meal to people who have no meal, that may only have one meal like that a year. That's a great gift to give. Allows them to see the rest of the people in the society that can be hidden from people. But no more gifts to anyone for any reason unless it's a non-monetary gift. And then give non-monetary gifts all you choose. To Bernie Sanders and his supporters. Bernie Sanders has some very good and valuable ideas when it comes to dealing with Wall Street and protecting Social Security and on some environmental issues as well. But the problem is Bernie is not a socialist. You may find that hard to believe. He is a democratic socialist, but that's like saying I'm a corporate liberal. Then you're not a true liberal. Or I'm a corporate conservative. Then you're not a true conservative. There are many principles that true conservatives have and true liberals have that are very much in alignment. It's the corporatization, it's the monetization that makes the difference. You see, Bernie is sponsoring the biggest economic giveaway corporate welfare package in American history. I'm not talking about the TARP or the ballot. I'm talking about his airplane that is manufactured also in Vermont. It is the most expensive armament ever built. You could build 10 warships for this one plane. We don't need the plane. It has been nothing but a headache. It has cost over $500 billion and is still dangerous. He also believes in supporting Saudi Arabia. He believes in getting rid of Assad. Does he know anything about the truth of why we're against Assad? Why even programs on Pacific are against Assad? The same programs that were against Libya. How did that work out? How safe is it now for the Libyan people? How many of the refugees that we're seeing live lives of destitution or dying in the efforts to get to another place had completely quality of life in Libya prior to Hillary Clinton and the corporate liberals and corporate Democrats and the neocons working together to destroy a country that posed no risk whatsoever to the world or us, nor did Syria's Assad. Once you know all the facts, and this coming Tuesday evening, I'm doing a two-hour special, providing you with insights, interviews, information to show you we, the United States and its intelligence agency, working with other countries, we decided to take down Syria. And you'll understand why Bernie Sanders should at least pause for a moment. But it gets worse. Bernie wants to support Saudi Arabia. Is he missing something on his briefings to see that one of the worst economic and humanistic crises in the world is now occurring based upon what Saudi Arabia is doing to Yemen? He should. Because there's now 21 million citizens, 21 million, who are food insecure, water insecure, and thousands have been killed by Saudi Arabia and its coalition. But it gets a little worse. Rightly condemn ISIS. But also, in the last year, Saudi Arabia beheaded more people, lashed more people, cut off more hands and arms and feet, stoned more people to death than ISIS. That's kind of hard to imagine. Where was the condemnation? Where was the boycotting of them? It didn't happen. We embrace them even more. Well, Bernie, here's the reality. If you, with your lifestyle and your sexual orientation, which I fully support, if you went to Saudi Arabia, you would be beheaded and then crucified. That is correct. And all the others within the gay community in Saudi Arabia, when they're caught, that is heresy there, and they're killed or imprisoned. Now, I'll add one more on to this, Bernie. Saudi Arabia, quote, declares all atheists are terrorists in new law to crack down on political dissent. This is from The Independent from the United Kingdom. Quote, Saudi Arabia has introduced a series of new laws which define atheists as terrorists, according to Human Rights Watch. In a string of royal decrees and the overarching new piece of legislation to deal with terrorists generally, Saudi King Abdullah has clamped down on all forms of political dissent and protest that could, quote, harm public order. And it means that if you're an atheist, according to Royal Decree 44, then you will be killed. So, Saudi Arabia offers all atheists death. How many members of the United States are atheists? How many members of Congress are atheists, actual atheists? How many members say they're Christian or Jewish or, you know, Muslim, but in point are not practicing? Imagine all those people being now considered atheists in Saudi Arabia and punished with death or imprisonment or lashings. What would you say if some of your friends were taken to a public square and flogged 1,000 times, which means after 100, they're going to die? Would you still say we should embrace Saudi Arabia and support them so they can do more in the Middle East? Have you not already seen what they're doing? So now you have no freedom of speech, you have no freedom of protest, you have no freedom of assembly, you have no freedom of religion unless it's the most radicalized terrorist form of Wahhabism. And if you're going to go after terrorists, Islamic terrorists, start with that. But we dare not speak its word in American media and political circles because they buy arms. Lots of it. $20 billion, $40 billion, $50 billion. And we get oil from them. Our hypocrisy, your hypocrisy, Congress's hypocrisy, the immediate hypocrisy is palpable. And let us not forget that what were the missing pages, the 28 pages, that we all want to know the content of? It was about Saudi Arabia and how they participated in 9/11. So isn't it just amazing what you're willing to say with your distempered nature, but what you're not willing to say in a common, reasonable way? If this is how ill-informed or misinformed or disingenuous you are, then people should take a really careful look at Jill Stein, who does not represent any of that condescension to truth. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you for listening. Look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day.